Let's turn our attention back to Isaiah chapter 33. We'll start at verse number 20. Remember that Isaiah is speaking these prophecies, writing these prophecies down sometime in the 720s BC. We know that the Assyrian Empire is sweeping south into the lower Middle East and will do a lot of damage as part of God's judgment for sin. Under the King Ahaz, southern Judah had also been engaging in a lot of bad sin, and so they have some judgment coming. Yes, King Hezekiah, especially in his solo reign, had responded to some of that bad stuff, but it was still there, at least under the surface. And so it will be judged. And ultimately, we'll have the judgment that comes under the Babylonians about a century and a half later. But mixed in with all of these things is mention of what's coming in the future. First coming of Jesus, second coming of Jesus, eternity itself. And so we got to keep our eyes open for those little nuggets in the midst of all of this judgment talk. So Isaiah 33, verse 20. Behold Zion, clearly a reference to Jerusalem, the city of our appointed feasts, meaning the ones that we have to show up for. Every adult Israeli male of reasonable health, living inside the boundaries of the Promised Land, was expected to go to Passover and unleavened bread at the beginning of spring, back again at the Feast of Pentecost, right before summer kicks in, and then right around the time of fall, Feast of Tabernacles. So, behold Zion, the city of our appointed feasts. Your eyes will see Jerusalem, an untroubled habitation, an immovable tent, whose stakes will never be plucked up, nor will any of its cords be broken. So that's clearly a reference to the time of Jesus' second coming, the establishment of the millennial kingdom, and eternity itself in the new heaven and the new earth in which righteousness dwells. Because only at that time can we say there is permanence to this place. Verse 21, but there he who is in majesty will be for us, a place of broad rivers and streams where no galleys with oars can go, nor majestic ship can pass. So there's a lot of water in the new heaven and new earth, just like there was a lot of water in the very beginning of earth. And these streams are not there for warships to pass on. This will be part of the prosperity of the eternal kingdom. For, verse 28, he who is our judge. He who is our lawgiver. He who is our king. He will save us. And so that's clearly about Jesus being the source of our salvation, being our judge, being the only one that gives the true law of love. Verse 23, your cords hang loose, probably a reference to the tent idea earlier. They cannot hold the mast firm in its place or keep the sails spread out. So now we move over to a nautical simile. Then prey and spoil in abundance will be divided. Even the lame will take the prey. So in the second coming of Jesus, the people who have handicaps, lameness, all that will be taken care of. New body, and they'll be able to chase things down. No inhabitant will say, I'm sick. The people who dwell there will be forgiven their iniquity. So everything's going to be fixed. Everything's going to be the way it's supposed to be. Chapter 34 now. draw near, O Goyim, O nations, non-Israelis, to hear and give attention, O peoples. Let the earth hear, and all that fills it, the world, and all that comes from it. For he who is enraged against all the nations, and furious against all their host. He has devoted them to destruction, has given them over for slaughter. Now, Isaiah is writing and prophesying in a time of the Assyrians sweeping through and doing the judgment of God. Later, it will be the Babylonians. After that, Persians. After that, Greeks. After that, Romans. It's always somebody that God was using as the instrument of his judgment. But eventually, we come to the ultimate day of the Lord. The second coming of Jesus follows up that day of the Lord, 3.5 years, where the nations will be gathered to Jerusalem and be dealt with for their sin. Verse 3, their slain shall be cast out, the stench of their corpses shall rise, the mountains shall flow with their blood. So a lot of judgment talk here. All the host of heaven shall rot away, and the scrolls roll up, the skies roll up like a scroll. Now, I grew up singing a song that talked about, and the skies shall roll up like a scroll. In the book of Matthew, we talk about things happening in the sky in relationship to the second coming of Jesus, in relationship to the day of the Lord. It shows up in Revelation chapter 6 again with some of that imagery. And so here is the Isaiah passage. All their hosts shall fall as leaves fall from the vine, like leaves falling from the fig tree. In the passages that I was just talking about in the New Testament, the stars are falling from the sky like a fig tree casting its unripe figs when it's shaken by a great wind. I believe and teach that in that context, that's talking about the fallen angels being booted out of the unseen world into the seen world at the beginning of the final 3.5 years before Jesus' second coming, an event that I refer to as angel fall. And so I am of the opinion that a lot of this wording here in Isaiah 34 is related to the ultimate day of the Lord and the second coming of Jesus that happens right after it. And that includes the fallen angels getting their punishment. Verse 5, for my sword has drunk its fill in the heavens. So the judgment against the heavenly angelic realm that had fallen against God very early on in creation's story. But then we read this, behold, it descends for judgment upon Edom, upon the people I've devoted to destruction. Now, in the time of Isaiah, the Edomites had caused trouble historically on more than one occasion for the Judeans, for the Israeli people as a whole. And God had meted out judgment against them. That seems to be the background here again in Isaiah's day, is that the Edomites are causing trouble, doing some sneak attacks and things like that. And this is the warning that God is taking that into account and he will bring judgment against them. But in the context where we're talking about things related to the second coming of Jesus, I think there's more to the story than just the historical events from Isaiah's time and back. We know that there are some passages alluded to in the book of Revelation that reference Jesus arriving in the air over the Middle East, having come from the region of Edom. And he has already been meting out judgment by that point in the story. And I think that matches what we're seeing here. So again, I think this section of Isaiah 34 has a lot to do with the second coming of Jesus. Verse 6, he who is has a sword, it's sated with blood. Remember that blades, like swords and knives, are thought to have mouths. The edge was referred to as a mouth. So they ate and they drank blood. And so this sword of the Lord has gotten its fill. It is gorged with fat, with the blood of lambs and goats, with the fat of the kidneys of rams. That's sacrificial talk. They've been butchering up animals as part of the sacrificial system to seek God's forgiveness. But then jumping from that imagery, this is what God sends through Isaiah. For he who is has a sacrifice in Bozrah. Bozrah is a major city in Edom, which is it's southeast from the Dead Sea. A great slaughter in the land of Edom. Wild oxen shall fall with them, and young steers with the mighty bulls. Their land shall drink its fill of blood, and their soil shall be gorged with fat. So we're talking about a battle scene here. For he who is has a day of vengeance, a year of recompense for the cause of Zion. So God is bringing judgment specifically against Edom for sins committed against God's people. And it is going to be massive in scope. Verse 9, the streams of Edom shall be turned into pitch, her soil into sulfur, her land shall become burning pitch. So now we're back to the imagery of fire, of sulfur and brimstone, which we associate in our modern context as Christians very often with the imagery of hell. And so this almost seems to locate the place of God's eternal judgment against the fallen angels, because remember, hell was created for the devil and his angels. That's from there at the end of Matthew chapter 25. But why would he create another place for all of the rebellious humans? Just throw them into the same place. And so this seems to be another one of the sources of what judgment awaits the angels and men who have rebelled against God. And apparently, Edom is connected somehow to the location of this place. Verse 10, night and day, it shall not be quenched. Its smokes shall go up forever. And that image, that verbiage shows up in the book of Revelation about God's judgment against the rebellious leadership of the world and the rebellious religious entity known as the Whore of Babylon in the book of Revelation. One of the other images that we have, even mentioned by Jesus, is that the final place of judgment for the devil, his angels, and all of the humans who have rebelled against God's grace, it will be a place of unquenchable fire. So we see that language here. From generation to generation it shall lie waste. None shall pass through it forever and ever. Again, this is pinpointing somehow the place we commonly refer to as hell as being in the general vicinity of Edom. Now, again, I'm just throwing some things out here because I don't know exactly how to apply all of this language perfectly. We know that in the new heaven and new earth, it will be righteousness only. Once the new Jerusalem comes down after the 1,000-year reign and Jesus puts down the rebellion that Satan is involved in, the new heaven and new earth is going to be graced with New Jerusalem. It appears to me as if the area that we think of as Edom, which is southeast from the Dead Sea, might be the entry point into what we would call hell. That's what I'm processing at this point in my teaching, and that is what this is trying to indicate. Verse number 11, but the hawk and the porcupine shall possess it, the owl and the raven shall dwell in it. That was a way that you often talked about a desolate place. It's not fit for human habitation, just wild animals live there. He shall stretch the line of confusion over it, the he here being God, and the plumb line of emptiness. Remember, he's been using these tools as part of his judgment process. Its nobles, there's no one there to call it a kingdom, and all its princes shall be nothing. So Edom is done as an independent entity. It is part of the historical record that during the time period between the Old Testament and the New Testament, that the Edomites that lived in ancient Edom were chased out by some Nabatean Arabians. And they took over that territory, and it became the Arabian kingdom, the kingdom that we see sometimes mentioned in New Testament period books. The former Edomites moved westward and started living in the south part of Judea. And while living there, they were forced to adopt, this is during the Maccabean period, right around 200 BC, I think. They were forced to adopt the Jewish faith as their own. And these are the ones that we refer to as the Idumeans. And you may remember that Herod the Great, and then his children after him that are mentioned in several places in the New Testament, they were all Idumeans. So they had the genetic background of the Edomites, but they had been living in the south part of Judean territory and had adopted the Jewish faith. And so the Edomites didn't exist anymore. Not really, by the time we get to the New Testament period. And so that matches some of the things we're seeing here. Back to verse 13. Thorns shall grow over its strongholds, nettles and thistles in its fortresses. It shall be the haunt of jackals and abode for ostriches, which I think it's actually some other bird, very loud and screechy. And wild animals shall meet with hyenas. The wild goat shall cry to his fellow. Indeed, there the night bird settles and finds for herself a resting place. Again, language that describes how desolate the place is, how it is just a place for wild animals. Verse 15, there the owl nests and lays and hatches and gathers her young in her shadow. Indeed, there the hawks are gathered, each one with her mate. Seek and read from the book of he who is. Not one of these shall be missing. None shall be without her mate. For the mouth of he who is has commanded, and his spirit has gathered them. So this part of this, at least, is talking about the desolation of Edom by the judgment of God coming against it in the time of the Assyrians, the time of the Babylonians, the time of the Persians, the time of the Greeks, the time of the Maccabees, the time of the Romans. until finally there is no more independent Edom country. It disappears. Verse 17, he has cast the lot for them, his hand has portioned it out to them with the line, they shall possess it forever, from generation to generation they shall dwell in it. So again, some of this stuff seems to be related to the history of Edom toward the tail end of its existence, but there also seems to be some indications here that it will be somehow related to what we think of as hell. Chapter 35. The wilderness and the dry land shall be glad. The desert shall rejoice and blossom like the crocus. So now we're back to blessing stuff. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it, which is heavily forested. The majesty of Carmel, again, heavily forested. And Sharon, a lot of vegetation. They shall see the glory of He who is the majesty of our God. So in the new earth, the places that are regionally located where deserts exist now, because there does seem to be the ability to reference topography based on current ideas in the new heaven and new earth. So in those places that are wildernesses, deserts, there will be great prosperity, lots of life. And no wonder, because we know in the new earth, it's going to be like the original earth before the fall into sin. And it was very lush, full of life. And all of that's going to happen again, and we will be able to see the glory of He who is, the majesty of our God. God Himself will be back in creation. You might remember that we have this little snippet in the book of Genesis that God came daily and walked with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Well, we're going to be going back to that. Once sin has been taken out of the equation, we can go back to paradise and we go back to seeing God all the time. Verse 3, strengthen the weak hands, make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who have an anxious heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. With the recompense of God, He will come and save you. Now, we know that Jesus' name, Yehoshua, means He who is salvation. And we know that the first time He came specifically to become the atoning sacrifice for sins. He came to save us. We were waiting for Him to come and do that. But at His second coming, He will be coming and giving us our new bodies. He will be giving the new earth into its existence as the old earth passes away. But one of the other items on the agenda at that time will be vengeance, recompense, payback. Jesus describes Himself as coming to pay back everyone according to their deeds. The righteous ones with eternal life, the unrighteous ones with eternal death. That is the second death, separation from God for eternity, in that place made for the devil and his angels. So I think this passage is once again back to the idea of the changeover from our current situation into the change to the second coming of Jesus. Verse 5, then the eyes of the blind shall be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Yes, a lot of that did happen during His first coming, but it will be permanently done away with His second coming. Then shall the lame man leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute sing for joy. For waters break forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. Prosperity again. The burning sand shall become a pool, the thirsty ground springs of water. In the haunt of jackals where they lie down, the grass shall become reeds and rushes. What a fantastic description of the new heaven and new earth. And then we come to a passage that we've talked about before. And a highway shall be there. It shall be called the Highway of Holiness. Remember, it stretches from ancient Assyria down to Jerusalem, and then from ancient Egypt up to Jerusalem. The unclean shall not pass over it. It shall belong to those who walk on the way. Even as they are fools, they shall not go astray. Even if they were fools, they shall not go astray. So, everybody walking on this highway is coming to see Jesus as he rules and reigns at Jerusalem in the new heaven and the new earth. And only the righteous are walking. No lion shall be there, nor shall any ravenous beast come up on it. They shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there. So wild animals, remember, go back to their peacefulness once the new heaven and new earth are in place, once Jesus comes back. Verse 10, and the ransomed of he who is shall return and come to Zion with singing. Wow, isn't that going to be amazing once we're in the eternal kingdom, once we're in the first part of the eternal kingdom, the millennial kingdom? We get to come and sing songs to Jesus in his very presence. We get to come to the place where he's ruling and reigning. And this is the blessing that we close with today. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. Zero doubt in my mind that we're talking about the second coming of Jesus, the millennial kingdom, the eternal kingdom, where every last one of us will have the joy of the Lord being our strength from that day forward. I hope you're looking forward to that. See you next time we get into the Word.